Welcome to Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast, where business leaders tell their stories and share their insights. All our guests have a personal connection with Nottingham Business School. So listen, learn, enjoy and share.
Welcome to another episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast with me, Mike Sassy. Caroline Wayman knows a thing or two about leadership under pressure. She was in charge at the Financial Ombudsman Service during one of the biggest financial mis-selling scandals in British history. Payment Protection Insurance, or PPI, was designed to cover loan repayments if borrowers became ill or unemployed. However, banks missold policies to hundreds of thousands of customers who were ineligible to claim. As Principal Ombudsman, Legal Director, then Chief Executive of the FOS, Caroline oversaw the handling of 2 million PPI complaints. At its height, her 4,500 staff were dealing with 12,000 complaints a week. Caroline led an operation that, over more than 10 years, forced banks to return £38 billion in compensation to customers. The scandal had a lasting impact on UK financial regulation. It reshaped modern consumer protection. Caroline originally trained as a barrister after graduating from NTU with a degree in law. Her career has since become come full circle. She now chairs the Board of Governors here at Nottingham Trent and has a busy day job leading the global financial services practice at PA Consulting. But even outside of work, she has always been a pioneering woman leader, because long before the Women's Super League, Caroline enjoyed a career as an accomplished amateur footballer, scoring more than 250 goals during two decades in the game. Now, for me, in my book, that's real leadership. Caroline Wayman, thanks very much for joining us here on this episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great stuff. So we'll have to start with that football. Tell us, when did that start? How did it start?
I think the stat's true, obviously, because it's on the internet, so by definition it's true.
I didn't look too carefully.
It was a mixture, actually, of playing. I used to play for Fulham Bells, which are a team that were... So it was a mixture of 11-a-side and 5-a-side. And I also played for the Ombudsman Services 5-a-side team for a number of years in the Power League. So I think the goal tally is probably mainly 5-a-side, to be fair. But don't let that interrupt the stat being a good one. Yeah.
And that's before where football was accessible to women, wasn't it?
Yeah, in lots of ways. I mean, my niece now, who's just turned 12, I mean, she plays. And I was saying to some friends, tennis is my sport now, and I was saying to some of my teammates in tennis the other day, one of the marks, I think, of progress is that my niece's hero in football terms is Alessia Russo, who's the Arsenal striker and just been named Player of the Year in the Women's League. And that's, in lots of ways, that tells you about the progress, because there were no real kind of role models in those days. And actually, you know, it was probably still a bit of a strange thing, you know, a bit more difficult to do. So I think that's fabulous progress. And I love that she has such access to the sport and that the women's game is growing so rapidly. I think it's fantastic to see.
But her auntie was ahead of her time.
maybe. I mean, there were leagues, and so, you know, it just wasn't as readily accessible, I guess. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, now back with your day job. Obviously, as I said, you were at the Financial Ombudsman Service for 20 odd years, seven of them as chief executive, and in particular dealing with that momentous PPI scandal. How do you look back and reflect on that now?
Yeah, I think I suppose there's a lot of pride about the work that we did, and you know, some real tough times, I think, some difficult moments, but actually, I mean, kind of, you know, as a need to grow rapidly and the need for innovation, I think that was something I learned a lot about. Because, I mean, I think, you know, previously, I mean, it's probably, just to put it in context, you know, we were probably about 1,200 people at the point that the PPI started to really kind of take off in terms of...
And this was a big national scandal for our younger listeners. This was a thing where people were getting text messages. Everybody was getting text messages saying, money has been set aside to pay for the wrongdoing of the banks. Why don't you go and get yourselves a share of that?
That's right. And I suppose it became that. But long before that, it was a set of issues that we at the Ombudsman identified, had to decide what we thought the approach should be, had to work very closely closely with the regulator to put in place arrangements for how things should be treated. And, you know, actually, as a sort of, what did we as an organisation have to do? We had to grow rapidly. So we effectively hired 1,000 people in two consecutive summers. And, you know, off a base of having about 1,200 people, we grew to about 4,500. So it was a massive kind of time of growth. And actually at a point where most things were shrinking, because this was around sort of 2011 sort of time. So, real kind of lesson in when you have to, you find a way.
Wow. So wait a minute. You went from 1,200, 1,500 staff to, did you say 4,000?
About 4,500, I think.
4,500
at the height.
There.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
How do you maintain motivation, morale, standards, all those things when you're under such great pressure to perform?
Yeah. I mean, I think in terms of motivation and morale, it's actually, particularly when we were growing, it was a time of real energy and excitement and innovation. And I think we had such a brilliant set of people that really got behind what we were trying to achieve and took a lot of pride in doing it really well. So we recruited lots of people. We recruited primarily on values, actually. So obviously people needed to be able to complete the casework and to be able to do the sort of thinking. And a lot of them were legal grads, actually, or kind of people with a little bit of experience of having worked at a law firm, paralegal, maybe in industry. But fundamentally, we said the most important, the non-negotiable is values. And if people have got the right values and behaviours, then we can teach them the rest. And that stood us in really good stead, I think. I think the other thing we did, which is something that, you know, is really even more relevant perhaps today with kind of the technology we have available, but we codified our answers to a really great degree. So we sort of took the view that it was better for kind of me and the ombudsman team to decide as many issues as we could rather than let all the brand new people decide individually. And so it was a real lesson in actually how far can you go in codifying answers and having a very structured, nowadays people think it's very straightforward. Actually, it's quite complex. It's an inherently quite complex product with lots of different facets sold in a multitude of ways.
So explain, if you can, in layman's terms, what were the banks doing?
So I guess there's a whole mix of things, really. And I guess it's important to say, that one end of the spectrum, the actual product is not a problem in itself, right?
So this is insurance.
So this is insurance to protect you, as you said in your opening, against if you lose your job due to sickness, unemployment, that sort of thing, that you have a means by which you can repay the lending, the loan or the finance that you've got in place. And so sort of fundamentally, that's actually quite a sensible thing. The problem was therefore not really with the product, but with how it was sold and to whom, and the relationship between the cost and the actual benefit that you received. So for a lot of people, they couldn't claim, in fact, because of their own circumstances, they're self-employed or had some kind of pre-existing medical condition, for example. And at times, people had the policies added without their knowledge or were pressured into having the policies. So it wasn't a good period in terms of, the conduct during that time. And I think the sector has learnt a lot from that as well.
And how did you... I hate to ask a really trite question, but there was a figure in there in my intro. Was it 38 billion pounds worth of money that the banks had to pay back to the customers? And they kind of... You must have dragged them out kicking and screaming to do that, isn't that right?
It sort of doesn't become that overnight, does it? I mean, I think, there's a very wide number. I suppose it was sold for decades. That's one of the things to put that in context. But it was definitely very contentious at different points in time. And, we at the Ombudsman and the FSA, as was, were judicially reviewed by the banks in about 2010, I think it was. And, there were subsequent legal cases as well. And so it was contentious in its early days. I think they reached a point where people recognised that this had not probably been everyone's finest hour and that it needed to be put right. And so that was what then unfolded. But... on a scale that really I don't think anybody probably in the world has seen, and let's hope we never see again.
Okay, so there was a great deal of public scrutiny at the time, not only of your organisation, but of yourself and your leadership. National TV headlines, as you would expect, but also government ministers having their say. How did you personally manage that pressure? How did you stay resilient?
Yeah, I think you learn a lot, I think, during those difficult times. And I mean, I think I learned a lot about the importance of having a really great team. And I did have a brilliant team around me. And I think being able to have a team that we'd all bought into what we were trying to achieve and we worked really well as a team, I think that was really important. I mean, one of my reflections is always, I think, that you know, when you look back, you think probably at times we should have been a bit less harsh on ourselves, but definitely there are things that you would do differently because that's life. And I think, you know, it's kind of an inevitable part of leading a big public-facing organisation. And on one level, I'd say it's absolutely right that you should face that level of scrutiny because you're doing things that matter and that have great impact on the industry itself and on consumers. And so it's only right that parliamentarians should scrutinise that. So it's kind of part of the job. I think on a personal level, though, I think you do sort of have to get your head around the fact that that is the case, that it's sort of not necessarily you're doing something wrong. It's just inherent in leading such a big organisation at such a kind of difficult time and through, you know, through inevitably choppy waters at times.
You just have to have a thick skin, do you?
I think you have to grow one. I don't naturally have a particularly thick skin, I don't think. I mean, I think it's interesting because I think one of the things I often say to people that when you transition from being a senior leader, as I did in the organisation, being kind of the legal director, principal ombudsman, you think that you're already kind of in the glare and that there isn't much of a shift maybe. But the shift's significant, I think, because when you're the chief executive, I think people don't really always think of you as a person. They think of you as a thing, as the office of. And so, and in lots of ways that you're sort of fair game for criticism and all the rest of it, which you sort of are, but that's hard at times. Yeah.
I mean, you're very philosophical about it, if you know what I'm saying. So, but being fair game, would you take on such a public role again?
I think maybe is my answer. And to some extent, I feel I'm very proud of the work I did, but I'm loving what I'm doing now. So I'm sort of not immediately, it's not something I've sort of got in my immediate sights. I mean, I do think the level of scrutiny that, you know, politicians and leaders in the public sector face, I do think it's a challenge to try and make sure that the atmosphere is not so febrile that you don't get people won't do it. I mean, personally, I would. It's, like I say, it's not something that's particularly in my kind of sphere of ambition right now. But I think that you do have to try and reconcile in yourself that this is not, you know, you're not facing the scrutiny because you've done something wrong. It's because it is just in the nature of it and it's whack-a-mole. You're constantly, you know, there's something and someone coming at you, coming after you. And yeah, I think that is challenging. There's no pretending otherwise.
Okay, in the middle of that, you said, of course, there are things one would do differently. Yep. Give me one of those examples.
I think we learned quite a bit as a team about the importance of internal communication and the sort of how quickly if you feel like you said something 5 minutes ago and actually everyone else is sort of feels like it's been ages and there's a kind of gap that opens up. And I think as well, you know, we went from being, as I mentioned, a kind of organisation of about 1,200 people to 4,500. I think how you communicate has to change when you grow because you sort of can't just get everybody in a room, for example. And as a leader, you have to work out how to sort of be present and to magnify your messages through a range of different ways. And I think those are some of the lessons, I think. I'm sure there's different choices we'd make, but I mean, fundamentally, I kind of think we got the big calls right for the most part. But equally, you know, for sure, there are things I'm sure that, you know, if you have your time again, you'd probably, you know, you'd have the benefit of that experience as well.
And, so. And you decided when you were going to go. You ever said nicely? You just said, "This is it. I'm off. See you." I I don't mean to be trite, but you chose when you were going and your manner of leaving.
Yeah, and you know, I kind of, you know, 7 years is quite a long time as a CEO, and you know, it's an organisation where it was always going to be with a heavy heart that I would leave it because I had so much kind of investment in it, and it mattered so much to me. The work mattered so much, and the people, you know, fundamentally, organisations are made up of people. And they're the things that matter, I think. So there was never going to be a moment where you could say, right, everything's sorted, there's a neat bow, and I, you know, it's finished. That was just never going to be. And so it was really a question of, you know, kind of, I guess for me, wanting to take on new challenges, do something different. And I think it's right for organisations as well. I think as leaders, the other thing you have to be sort of to think is, at different points, you know, different leaders should come in and do different things, and that's good for the organisation as well.
So you mentioned it there, doing different things. Today you lead the global financial services practice at PA Consulting. You're recognised as an expert in consumer issues, governance, leadership. But how did those 20 years shape your views today on leadership?
Yeah, I mean, I think you learn a lot from being a leader and doing things. And so I find now when I'm helping organisations to hopefully navigate their own choppy waters, I do so from a place of having been there and done it, which is enormously valuable. I mean, I think the other way I sometimes describe it is that kind of every big financial services, retail financial services thing that's happened, and perhaps particularly the things that haven't gone so well, has probably come across my desk in some shape or form.
And that's a great line, isn't it? Yes. If something hasn't gone well, they've come to me about that.
That's right. And of course, you might expect that to make me cynical, but it doesn't. I mean, actually, in lots of ways, how I describe it is that my job at the Ombudsman was in large part trying to help financial businesses to do the right thing for their customers. That's what I do today as well. And you know, I fundamentally believe that that is what the vast, vast majority of businesses are trying to do. And they need some help sometimes with navigating that and making the choices that they have to make. And particularly in, you know, financial services, a very highly regulated environment. But at its heart, I guess the central thread for me is I'm always trying to help make things better for customers. And I know that sounds a bit trite, but that is my golden thread, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I read something that you wrote about that earlier this year about the future of financial services. And it comes back to when you were talking about hiring people originally, values, 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 values. Good leadership, is it always values driven?
I think it kind of has to be at its heart, because otherwise, what else guides you?
Making money?
Well, sure. And I guess that is what, I mean, I suppose that's one of the things, actually, probably another reflection I have is you have to sort of recognise as a leader, not everyone sees the world like you do. So for me, it is values and making a difference in the world and all the rest of it. And, you know, that's probably my biggest driving force.
Making a difference?
Yeah, making a difference. Yeah, for sure, for sure. I think that definitely motivates me, and wanting to feel that, you know, you've made something better. And in consulting, actually, that's a big part of what your job is. And it's actually, you know, having been a CEO, you might think I'd find it difficult not to be doing and not to be the one driving it. But actually, I take a lot of pleasure from helping advise and shape, and feeling that when I've kind of advised an organisation, worked with an organisation, I leave them in better shape than when I arrived. And that's kind of something I take great pride in as well.
So now we're going to take a quick break from our chat to mention the MBA programmes at Nottingham Business School. As we've learned from many of our guests, effective business leadership is about confidence, adaptability, and thinking strategically. These are the key ingredients to delivering innovation and impact in crowded, competitive markets. So if you are ready to transform your career, visit ntu.ac.uk/MBA. Explore the MBA programmes at Nottingham Business School. We're one of only 1% of business schools worldwide who hold the prestigious Triple Crown accreditation. That's ntu.ac.uk/MBA to find out more. Now back to the show. In recent years, you've also had a number of non-executive roles, but you've also served on the board of the Crown Prosecution Service. I've just plucked that out there. I find that interesting because going back to the start of your career, when you originally qualified as a lawyer after studying law here at Nottingham Trent, you didn't go into the law. And I read something which said that you didn't find a pupillage with a barrister's practice simply because you didn't know anyone, or perhaps you didn't know the right people. Now, I'm guessing it might have just been a throwaway line from you, so I hope I'm not making more of it than it actually was. But for today's graduates, Is it still as important who you know as what you know?
It sounds like a slightly petulant line, doesn't it? So
I'm sure it wasn't.
I'm not sure I put it quite as blatantly as that. But I definitely think that certainly at the time, that was, you know, definitely a feature of the legal market. And I remember kind of arriving at Basker, which at the time you could only study the course in London. It was the Inter Court School of Law, as was. And, you know, and it was quite a big sort of shift, really. And it's only really in more recent years I've kind of realised why it felt so uncomfortable being in that environment, because actually in large part I was sort of surrounded by people who'd come from probably, you know, private school education to Oxbridge to, you know, to the bar, and actually a lot of that is quite similar in it's a sort of continuum of dining in halls, which so dining many, in halls was not a thing I had done before.
Well, there weren't many Sunderland-born applicants. They is weren't. That what you're saying?
That's right. And, you know,
I say that because I know you were born in Sunderland.
Indeed, I was born in Sunderland, and, you know, kind of, I think if I think about times in my career where probably, you know, imposter syndrome is probably at its height. And I didn't know that's what it was, but I remember feeling very uncomfortable. I think it's better now. I definitely think it's better now. But I'm sure there's still an element in most industries that, you know, kind of does mean that having those connections it helps. I mean, it's part of why I'm really passionate, actually, about a lot of the work we do at NTU and how, actually, through education, through opportunities, we can open up doors for people, because I, you know, really believe that we have to try and find the best talent and help people to come through. And I hope it's a lot better today.
I'm guessing it also illustrates the importance of networking.
And that's right. And that's sort of one version of who you know, isn't it? And on one level, that's kind of just completely natural and all the rest of it. But I think it's probably quite important to recognise that it's not a skill that people are sort of born with. And you sort of have to find your own way in that as well. I mean, my own view in that is I don't think networking is particularly, you know, it's not for me. It's not sort of going to conferences and just working the room. I think, you know, that's kind of like, sure, that's fine, but it doesn't really, I have literally never, I don't think, apologies.
You've never worked a room?
I probably worked a room, but I can't think that I've ever really made a meaningful, lasting connection in that context. I find much more often I meet people through a range of different ways, and then you build a relationship. And, you know, consulting is fundamentally a relationship-driven business. And I'm a big believer that, you know, you kind of build trust with people, and then that's who you turn to, because trust is, you know, such a fundamental thing, isn't it?
Absolutely everything. So you've talked quite passionately, I think, there about Nottingham Trent, where you're now chair of the governors, and in that role you're heading up the current process to find a new vice chancellor to replace Professor Edward Peck, who's also been a guest on this pod. He's over the last 11 years been, I think, by anybody's measure, a very successful leader. So all my colleagues would like me to ask you, what are you looking for in his replacement?
Yeah, I mean, he's a tough act to follow, isn't he? I think is the first thing to say. I mean, you know, there'll be many occasions where we'll pay tribute to Edward, but I mean, he's been absolutely brilliant. I think he's such a good leader, more than a good leader, he's a great leader. And it's been an absolute pleasure to work with him. I mean, I suppose fundamentally a great leader probably therefore is where I start from, because...
Well, will they already be a great leader, or will they become a great leader when they get here?
You know, they will likely be someone who will continue to grow. I mean, I think that will be something we'd be looking for, is somebody who has growth potential. And we all do, and we should all continue to find that in ourselves, I think. And, you know, and I think NTU has a kind of brilliant spirit of innovation, and, you know, we're never satisfied really here if we're just in the pack or, you know, kind of catching, we never want to be catching up with other people. That's, you know, that's dull.
Okay, so wait a minute, you're making it very difficult for this individual.
I know.
What will the qualities be?
Well, I think actually it's sort of a bit of a balance, actually, because you need someone who can think, help us to go, well, what's next and where do we go next as a university, and what can we, because, you know, Edward obviously has achieved a great deal during his tenure. I think the other bit, though, that's really important is we need somebody who will build on the legacy that we have and on the fantastic stuff that we do. So sort of don't want somebody who's going to start, you know, ripping things up and saying we've got to start again, because we fundamentally don't believe that's where we're at. I think, you know, any organisation has, you know, we always have challenges, you always have things you want to do better, but you know, it's a great platform and it's a very well-respected university.
And so you're looking for a continuity candidate?
No, I think I don't think that quite captures it, because I think it's not just sort of because I think staying steady is going backwards. Okay. So we can't really, and I don't think anybody here, you know, all the people I meet, and I interact with obviously quite a lot of people, at, you know, one of my favourite things I do is graduation ceremonies twice a year. And, you know, you get to chat to all sorts of people. And that's sort of the point of all of it, isn't it, really? You kind of go, yeah, this is why we're all here. This is the point. And so, yeah, I think somebody who just felt that it was a sort of steady as you go, that probably wouldn't work for us. But I think it's building on what we've done, where we've been, and then actually being able to kind of develop a strategy for the future, working with colleagues across the university as well.
Because the sector faces a few challenges, doesn't it?
Yeah, for sure. And as most sectors do, you know, we don't sort of live in calm times, do we? There's sort of never an absence of turbulence, and universities obviously have a lot of scrutiny as well, back to what we were talking about earlier. You know, it's the kind of, they are organisations that are always going to face quite a lot of scrutiny, and, you know, it's well publicised that the sector's had challenges, but I think NTU has navigated those really well so far, and absolutely every confidence will continue to do so. But that, you know, that inherent in that is being able to make choices, being able to make decisions, being able to see, well, what are our customers, what are our students of the future, what do they want from us? That's the fundamental question. So what do we need to be to meet the needs of our students of the future? And that's kind of the big question I think we'll be asking as part of our next strategy cycle.
Okay. So you're here giving a guest lecture at the Nottingham Business School tonight, and I notice it's entitled Never Go Back. So in leadership terms, what do you mean?
I think that there's a bit of a tendency at times in the kind of public discourse for people to think there was a time before when everything was lovely and all was well and it was, you know, and I kind of think two things. I think, well, firstly, it probably wasn't really as calm or rosy as that, in fact, because there's sort of always something, isn't there? But even if it was, there is no going back. And actually, one of the things I think we have to do as leaders is to not wait for calmer times, but to be able to make decisions with imperfect information at times. And that's one of the really challenging things you do. And something, you know, I experienced quite a lot of at the Ombudsman at times was needing to say, well, we don't know everything. We're going to make some choices. They won't all be right either, but we'll learn from them. If we get them wrong, we'll understand why, we'll listen and we'll learn. And so I think for me, it's about saying we keep looking to the future rather than looking back. I think that would be my main message.
Okay. And finally, as you know, this is a podcast for the Nottingham Business School, Business Leaders Podcast, a place where we have a lot of leaders and a lot of aspiring leaders. So if I was to ask you for one single important piece of advice picked up during your own career, what might that be?
It's hard, isn't it, to think of a single nugget. I kind of think believe in yourself and don't be too hard on yourself. Most really great leaders that I've met and I deal with today, I find are very, very tough on themselves. And so it actually is important at times to recognise the importance of your own well-being and not to be so tough on yourself. And really successful people are, and you look at it, same in sport, you know, they're kind of incredibly tough on themselves. That's part of what makes them successful. So it's inherent in lots of people to give themselves a hard time. But at times, it's just be a bit kinder to yourself and look after yourself fundamentally.
Be kinder to yourself. I love that. Caroline Wayman, it has been a real pleasure to have you here as a guest for this episode of the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast.
Thank you very much.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast with Caroline Wayman, why not listen to previous episodes with the Chair of the Football Association, Debbie Hewitt, MBE, the former Vice President of Toyota Europe, Marvin Cook, OBE, or the Vice Chancellor of Nottingham Trent University, Professor Edward Peck, CBE. This episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast was produced by Russell Bingley and presented by Mike Sassy.